Salud.
Salud.
Thank you guys so much for doing this After Hours podcast. I'm here with Rosie, and I'm here with Mayra.
Mayra. Judge Rosie.
I'm sorry.
I like to tell people I'm only a judge when I'm in a robe.
I like that.
Otherwise, you know, I'm just like everybody else. Subject to the same.
Right.
I like that.
Well, I think what I want to say is I admire you very much.
Oh, thank you.
You are a great friend, and I guess, you know, we crossed paths back when I was at CASA.
Yes.
As supervisor. And so I can remember your passion in the courtroom. So when Jorge asked about, you know, if you've ever, your emotions in the courtroom, it's like, oh, I've seen it. I've seen her, how she gets, because she gets really passionate about what she does. I can go back to that one case when she was mentioning that she sometimes would work on Fridays and Saturdays. And it's totally true, because we had a case together where she would go out and see this child that was living in a center for children. And she had this thing, right, where he had to keep up his grades, and she, you bought him shoes.
Yes.
Remember that? Yes. That case?
And I'll just call him D.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was J. His case was a high profile case when he was removed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was horrible. The stuff you read about in the big cities, you never think it's going to happen in San Antonio. But that kid that was locked out in the shed inside of a neighborhood that nobody knew he was even in there. And, you know, when they found him, he had a 5-gallon bucket for his bathroom, and he had wrappers of McDonald's all over the floor, and he was sleeping on the floor on a sleeping bag. Because, you know, mom's boyfriend didn't want him in the house, kind of thing. And, you know, he was lice infested. He smelled, you know, and he was removed from mom and placed with a relative. And then that relative had her own issues with a paramour that led to us having to remove him from her. And so now he was floating around from, you know, boys' residential home to boys' residential home, and he had behavior issues. And I needed to find a motivator for him. And because he was acting out, not following the rules, being disrespectful, being very, very ugly and defiant with women specifically. So my goal for me and him was to have him have a positive relationship with a woman, and that, you know, he wasn't going to get that with me without him earning it, and that he would put whatever he put out, he would get back. If he had bad behavior, he wouldn't see me. And that's how I did it. Yeah, I would talk to him over the phone, but I wasn't going to come by and pick him up and take him to go shopping or to the movies or to go out to eat if I did not see positive behavior. And that was something I learned from my parents with me and my brother. My mom was very strict in the sense of she would buy grades, only A's. She wasn't going to buy a B or C or, you know, but if we got A's, she would pay us for our grades. And so that instilled in us that, you know, positive gets a positive. And so I had this way of, you know, okay, Jay, you know, you got to do this. And if you can achieve this little behavioral goal, I'm going to come pick you up on Saturday. And we're going to get whatever you want to eat, and I'll buy you a new pair of tennis. Well, he loved it. Mm-hmm. I hope he's doing well. I think he had a little hard of a transition with his new attorney, but I think things have kind of leveled off for him. He's probably now, you know, at least 15 or 16. Right. And his dream was to play NFL football, and I hope that happens for him.
Right. I mean, that was the thing. I remember that he was on a segment, remember, that we got him on the,
yes,
on the Wendy's Kids to see if someone would adopt him. And that was like, he came out on the news and everything, and he was so cute. He was just talking about himself and how he really wanted a family and how he wanted. He said, I don't care if I get a mom and a dad, or dad and a dad, or a mom and a mom. I just want a family.
All we want is love in this world, really. That's
right.
All it is just
love.
Well,
as children, you know, and I think something that with all of the cases, you know, that we have seen with child abuse and everything, and I think this is the hard part for people to kind of wrap around their head, is that at the end of the day, these children truly love their parents.
Oh, yeah. When I was a caseworker at CPS, the children that had suffered and survived the most horrendous description of any abuse that anyone could imagine were the very same children who wanted to live back with their parents. And I think that people miss the awareness that where these children were living with these parents, that was their whole world. They didn't know that how they were being treated was even abuse, because that's all they knew.
That was their love.
That was
their
love.
Form of
that,
love.
You know,
yeah,
if they did this or that inside the house, that, you know, some way or another, this deviant behavior defined love for them. And so that's the biggest challenge with some of these kids that have to get reparented and replaced with a new family, and is undoing all the bad, all the damage that was caused to their psyche, to their self-esteem, to their sense of security, all those things that are so important to the development of children. They were robbed of that. And so it's really hard to rewire a child. I think Frederick Douglass had a great quote, which is that it's much easier to fix, what is it, a hurt child than it is to fix a damaged man. Mm-hmm. You know, something to that effect. I don't, you know, it's not a direct quote, but, it's so hard to undo the damage in an adult, and so much easier to simply reroute a young person in the right direction. But those abuse cases were horrendous. And children have proven time and time again to be extremely resilient, very loving, regardless of the tremendous abuse that they've endured. Now, there are those cases where, you know, the oldest sibling abused the younger siblings, and they could never be placed together because it was maybe of a sexual or sadistic nature. So there are cases where the repair is beyond what we can offer the family or that child, and they usually have to get institutionalized for long periods of time. But these kids were amazing. I mean, just to that kid, I hope he's doing well. And there are foster families and adoptive families that still to this day keep in touch with me, because I was that lawyer that was able to get their adoption done or free up the child so that they could adopt them. Folks that never in their wildest dream imagined that they could be a parent to that and love to that capacity, the children that they adopted.
So, like, for the month of November, right, that's when would they do the mass? That didn't happen. Or did they do on Zoom?
I haven't heard of a mass adoption happening, even on Zoom. It may have happened, but I don't
really
remember.
Cool,
I know that
adoptions.
They are doing, specialty court graduations on Zoom. Gotcha. So it wouldn't surprise me if they have had one or if there's one in the planning stages. A lot of the whole pomp and circumstance for the family is to actually, have people present and to have the experience of the ceremony with the judge and the forever family and the gift cards and balloons. So, you lose all that with Zoom. But I know there's people that have gotten adoptions granted by Zoom. I do know that in here and in other parts of the state.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I never thought there would be like
that. So the month of November is National, I think, Adoption Month. The month of November. And so what they do here in Bexar County, usually at the Freeman Coliseum, they'll get all the people that want to do a mass adoption and adopt their child on a certain day in November, they all go out there and they do, the two judges are there, the ones that oversee those cases.
So they do like one ceremony.
One big ceremony.
But all the orders come in and we have to sign them, stamp them.
It's really nice.
Yeah. And it's kind of like what we do for Valentine's Day.
Right.
Me and Lucy Adama Clark
would
marry hundreds of couples on Valentine's Day. Yeah. I think this year what we're planning, Lucy's starting to plan it already, is do some sort of drive-in, drive-up marriage where you're going to be able to park in a large field. And we're going to do the ceremonies from afar. So just to, and have it in schedules. Mm-hmm. Like the first round of cars is going to come at a certain hour and the second round of cars at another hour. So, yeah, there's a will, there's a way, right?
So tell us a little bit about your wedding. How long have you been married?
Stacy and I were married in 2017. And I say that because in 2016, that's when we first started dating, and it was that election cycle. And we got married on September 17th of the following year, which was 2017. And it was a very small private ceremony on Marriage Island on the Riverwalk.
Oh, okay.
But then we thought we'd have a public wedding where we could invite whoever we wanted. We did. If we saw you on the street and we knew you, you got invited. But it was a cruise. It was an Alaskan cruise. So it was a 1-800 number that they could call, and if they wanted to, join us and attend our wedding on the boat, on the cruise liner, they could, but they, of course, had to, pay for their own trip. But once they were there, it was all people that kind of, we all knew each other. We had about between 40 and 50 people show up.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so, and we're all on the cruise, and we went to Alaska, and we did the whole,
Did you get to see whales?
Yes, but I saw more whales in Bandera Bay near Puerto Vallarta.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Then I did, we saw a few whales going up to the Alaskan coastline.
What month was it?
The cruise, for both. The cruise was in July, mm-hmm. but Puerto Vallarta was in December. So there was some information that it could have been the same pod of whales because they travel back and forth. And so, yeah, we were in Alaska and we saw whales. We did the husky dogs. We went up the train up the mountains and, visited parts of Canada. It was great. We loved it. Went up to the glaciers. We then went kayaking. Went to an island on the kayaks that was full of bald eagles. So it was a great experience. And then on the way back that July, so that was July of 2018. On the way back, we caught the Starlight Express from Seattle all the way down to Los Angeles. So we came in a train and we had our own little private little cabin in the train, little car, and it went along Pacific Coast Highway. So it was
gorgeous
scenic route. And we got to LA and then we went from the train station and stayed at a hotel. And then we caught the flight out the next day and came back to San Antonio.
And went to court.
Went to court. Yep, pretty much.
So I was telling Jorge that I guess it's a blog or the one that you have where you tell all the stories about your childhood growing up.
Are stories that, they're called Manguera memories because...
Your Guerra memories?
They're called Manguera memories. And, for me, I think the first one was, I was watching a water hose and it just kind of jettisoned me to a specific moment in time, and I remember at that moment being on the patio in my parents' house and the Manguera was on and we're all spraying each other and just, childhood experiences. And that kind of became a series. And La Prensa asked me to publish with them. And that's what you would see. You would see what was just about to get published or had just gotten published in La Prensa newspaper. And there's about 20-something stories. And I know that COVID has kind of slowed us down, but we had talked about putting the collection of stories in a small book and then dedicating half of the proceeds of the sale of that book to fund the scholarship, the La Prensa scholarship. And our talks kind of stopped there. But, they're all saved. I need to get them off my personal laptop, which I haven't used almost all of COVID, and open that up again because everything is stored on that Surface Pro, and haven't gotten it up and running again. I guess I need to take to computer shop and get all the memory transferred to another computer.
So do you still have your motorcycle?
I do.
Okay.
You got a motorcycle?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Davidson 1500 touring bike. And I try to ride it on Wednesday, so I'll take it out tomorrow. Oh, cool. The weather's good. And I ride it to work. Wednesdays is the day I don't have court. So I don't have to worry too much about helmet hair and, wearing the right... I can wear a t-shirt and some jeans and boots. And
I remember one time when Caso, the office, was here on San Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
And you were coming on your bike and I was in the parking lot. And you just passed by and you zoomed or whatever with your bike. You're like, what's up? And, and I was like, hi.
I was like, that was pretty cool. I thought. And every time I think of you, that's the image that pops in my mind. When they say,
the biker chick.
Judge Rosie, that's the image that I have of you on your bike yelling at me, what's up?
that's awesome.
Funny. Yeah.
Keep people on their toes.
I like that. I want to get a motorcycle, but I think that would give my mom a heart attack, especially the type of person I am. So
I didn't ask permission when I did it. I was already my whole life I rode when I was 16, 17. There was a good friend of mine, Joanne, her boyfriend Jim rode dirt bikes and he taught all of us how to ride those dirt bikes. And then I had an opportunity to take one around the neighborhood in my 20s and I said one day I'm going to own a motorcycle. I ended up with my very first motorcycle as a result of a CPS jury trial.
Oh, wow.
And I represented grandparents who wanted their grandchild out of a sibling set in which one of the other children had died. And so the parents were facing criminal charges and these grandparents wanted their grandchild out of that sibling set. They didn't want their grandchild to be raised in foster care. But their son was one of the accused. So we had a jury trial on it. The son relinquished his rights. The mom relinquished her rights to all the children. The jury was out for 2 or 3 days and it was against Kimberly Burley. I thought she had won and she thought I had won. And in the end, the grandparents took nothing. They didn't did not get the child. But what's more sad is that their son relinquished his parental rights. Then the criminal case got dismissed against him. So there was never any criminal charges against him. And so whenever I had a client that had criminal charges pending, I would tell them, you know, don't give up your rights. You've not been found guilty of anything. And let's fight. And some of them would. You know, there was, you know, some that I lost and some that I won. But there's certain mechanisms that kick in with CPS cases. For example, if a parent is charged with a criminal offense in regard to a child, and they come to the CPS court and get on the stand, and they invoke their Fifth Amendment right to stay silent because it could jeopardize their criminal case. Yeah. In civil cases, the fact that they invoke that Fifth Amendment right to stay silent triggers the presumption that they are culpable of some wrongdoing in the Child Protective Services case. So it works against them. By the time I was done practicing, if I had a parent, and I did towards the end, that was facing criminal charges, had open cases on the criminal side, I would tell him not to show up for the CPS court. So that way they wouldn't call him onto the stand and he didn't have to invoke his Fifth Amendment right. But I also said, but you got to work your services, because nowhere in the service plan does it say you will attend your hearings. What it does say is that you'll complete these services. So I need you to complete your services and I'll go to the hearings. And that's how, you know, I navigated that last one of those last cases that I did. And it was a lot because he had some really serious charges against him in regard to what was alleged he had done to his children. So I had
to. Now I know why my dads weren't showing up to court.
You know?
When she was their attorney.
You know, at one point, I remember having a dad who never showed up to court. I never met him. And the department tried to terminate his rights. He was one of three or four dads in the case. Well, the department wanted his rights terminated because he didn't respond to their lawsuit, but they never established that he was the children of the father, and the father of the children. I remember Judge Knoll said he granted my motion to cut him out of the suit and dismiss the case against him because the department didn't prove he was the father. But they had gotten into the custom of just terminating whoever got named as the father, even unknown fathers, terminating their rights because they couldn't find him.
So what's the best rehabilitative story that you could think of? I guess right now, currently, in your domestic violence docket.
You know, I don't think I've been on the bench long enough to see the fruits of some of the efforts.
Exactly.
Now, I can tell you, I've had a couple of occasions where I enter like a restaurant. And, mm-hmm. you know, the waiter is somebody out of my court that I sentenced, mm-hmm. you know, and they'll come up to me and they said, mm-hmm. what you ordered me to do was the best thing. This is what I've learned. And I said, well, I'm glad you're doing what I've ordered you to do. You know, I'm encouraging you to keep it up so I don't have to see you in court and I can just see you here as a waiter, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's been a couple of times when that happens. In regard to children that I've represented, you know, it's unfortunate, but the ones that contact me are the ones out on the street. They're homeless, they're struggling. And so it's hard to see that happen to our foster kids.
And I think that's, I'll be really honest. Like, I think right now with my career change, you know, that I'm at Incarnate Word, I think that's the hard part, is that I feel like I'm doing a disservice to my community. Like, I love my job. I love what I'm doing. I love UIW, but I also...
You want to do more.
I know. I want to do more. And I feel like every time I try to steer away from it, I'm pulled back into it in some sort or way. And with that, like what you were saying, that sometimes you walk into a restaurant. I had, when I was at CASA, I was doing the crossover cases. So specialty
juvenile court.
Right, with Judge Jerry.
Yes.
And so I recently had one of my cases from the crossover docket reached out to me on Facebook. I don't even know how he found me.
But he was looking for
you. I know.
And what does that say about how he values you in his life?
And you know what? The good thing is it was positive. I mean, it was kind of negative, but positive, because he said, because I guess he was assuming I was still with CASA. So he messaged me and he said, hey, I know I'm not supposed to be reaching out to you, but I really wanted to tell you I'm doing fine. I have a son now. So, you know, he got his girlfriend pregnant and whatnot. And he said, you know, my sister is doing good. She's in high school. We're all good. Mom, I think, is battling cancer, but she's going through treatment.
But it was important for him to tell you he was doing well and that you know that he was doing well.
Yeah. I was like, how did he even remember my name?
kids remember.
That's so crazy. So I messaged him back and I said, hey, you know, glad to see you're fine and happy for you. Be careful. Stay safe out there. But it was interesting. And yeah, I mean, from my time in mental health, I think usually if I go to Walmart or HEB, I'll see some of my consumers, you know, mm-hmm. working out there. And obviously, because they're a little bit intellectually disabled, like they don't remember me, but it's kind of, they're out there. I mean, once you're out in the community doing this kind of work, you know so many people. And
Everybody kind of steps all over each other, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
is that awkward for you guys when you guys have like those interactions?
I think it depends on who's on the other end. I mean, if it was a client or a child that you knew you had difficulties with, then there can be a level of apprehension as to whether I, you know, do I respond? Should I even, you know, acknowledge? And then there's those who you just want to hug, right? No matter when you see them, because you had that connection with them. So, you know, it's with anything else. It just depends on that connection between you and that other individual.
What about for yourself? Like when you found someone guilty, giving you like a look or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I've had lots of that throughout all my careers. You kind of have to grow thick skin, and you can't read into a whole lot of stuff, you know, because sometimes it's mixed signals. Sometimes it's not what you think it is. And I think it just comes from everything that we have to experience. We never know. Yeah. The more we're exposed to, the more range of things that we think could possibly happen. You know, the more we're sheltered and the less exposed we are. We don't imagine that people can be that ugly or that mean or that selfish or that self-centered. But the more you get to know people, the easier it is to believe that that is exactly what's happening. And so, you know, I think over time, you just learn to discern, you know, with your maturity and, you know, kind of cut the BS, right?
Yeah, because a lot of times, I mean, you get name called all sorts of stuff. You B, you F, yeah. You this.
So you learn to pick.
After hours, you could say
it. You learn to pick your battles.
Yeah,
every battle is worth fighting, you know? Not every individual is worth your time or your effort to try and respond to. Many a times, it's so much easier to just
walk away.
Hasta el menso, yeah. And walk away. I didn't hear it. You know,
you
I'm not acknowledging it.
You can't have an ego. Like, you can't have an ego and be like, oh, he's calling me a whatever. Like,
you know, I'm going to be real frank. I'm not going to care really what you think unless you pay my bills,
yeah.
You
absolutely.
Know? Uh-huh. I mean, that's amongst
right.
adults, you know?
No, so
right.
We always have our egos. We tend to overthink things a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was listening to a report. Check this out. This was maybe two or three days ago because I talked to Stacey about it. And I said, you know, I was listening. Maybe it was on NPR or something. But the propensity of children, how y'all feel about this, that children who were raised by very strict adults, parents, had a higher propensity to lie as young adults and teenagers and to overthink issues in their life.
Their abilities and stuff like that?
Well, everything. They just overthink everything because of the fact that they had to like live alternate universes or alternate lives. The life that their parents wanted them, the parent wanted them to be, but then they wanted to be their authentic selves. And so they lied about things.
Yeah.
You know, whether that was who their friends were or where they were. And then as adults, they develop into overthinkers, always trying to think of everything because they had to because they were lying to their parents.
Yeah.
Because their parents
totally
were too strict.
I agree. Yeah, of course. Because they had to cover up everything.
Yes.
Constantly trying to come up with a scheme, a creative
yes.
way. I mean, the positive side is maybe you have some really creative kids, but the other side, it's like, wow, you're really
that's
not
a lot
your authentic
of energy.
Self. Like,
right.
Not your authentic self because you're having to constantly portray something that you're not.
Right. And Mark Twain put it the most simple way, which is always tell the truth that way I'd never have to remember what I said.
Right.
I like that.
And if the truth hurts, well, hey.
Well, you know, there's a new book called Green Lights. It's a book by Matthew McConaughey. And one of the quotes in that book is, the only truth that hurts is a lie.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
The only truth that
hurts
is
a lie.
That makes sense.
Right? I mean,
because the truth is the truth. There's not good truth or bad truth. It just is what it is.
It's the fact.
It is what it is.
But if it's a lie, if you're presenting the truth, then it's based on fiction, on a fallacy, then it's hurtful. It's hurtful to somebody.
And the crazy thing is, as humans, we're so afraid to tell the truth sometimes.
And what are you afraid of, you know?
That's great. Yeah. Honestly, what are you afraid of?
Usually
okay,
people,
so what happens if you're rejected?
Whatever.
What happens? Are you going to die if you're rejected?
You're not going to die. You're not going to die.
Exactly.
Nothing.
Nothing happens. You move on.
No. You don't move on. You move forward.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
You move forward. Yeah, there's this book that Mayra gave.
But in some cases, you do move on. You don't need that person in your life. You move on. Now, I agree with you. You move forward and you learn to live with things like the death of a parent. Yeah. You never get over a death of a parent or a child. You don't move on from that. You learn to move forward. You learn to move with, you live with the loss and you carry it with you. And you work on taking the positives out of that relationship with you everywhere. As their legacy, you know? So there is a difference between moving on and moving forward.
Hey, you got me there.
You stopped.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm pretty sure your parents weren't expecting you to be this badass that you are right now.
I don't know what they were expecting, but, you know, I'm sure they both had, you know, in their individual way, some goals and dreams for me to achieve.
And your tattoos, too. That's pretty cool. You
know? No, so my dad had one. He had a crucifix, and it had, like, a circle behind it. And it looked very much like a neighborhood kind of crude, self-made, or somebody in the neighborhood made tattoo, but he had it on his forearm. And I always said, you know, I mean, that'd be so cool to have a tattoo like my dad, you know, growing up. And then I was well into my 20s when I got my first tattoo.
What was it?
A little phoenix on the top of my little shoulder, and I had that by itself for a long time. And then I went and got the Virgen, and then it just kept adding and adding and adding. And so right now I have both my arms. That's the only place I have my chest tattoo and a couple of my back, and I'm done. The chest tattoo was the last one I got, and
it's painful.
It is wings with the Sacred Heart, and it took about 5 sittings because at about 10 minutes each time. My tattoo artists are the best. They're Cardi and Jerry Garcia over at Calaveta Tattoo, and I've known them for years, for decades. But Cardi, and she's the one with the lighter hand, would start on my sternum, and for some reason, when the needle would start to hit the bone, there was a muscle in my back. You can see like the back of my back, and you could feel it start to torque, like twist.
Like in the lower back area?
Right here. And then my back would start to arch. Out of my control completely. It was a reflex, a reaction. And she would have to just, okay, come back next weekend. We'll try and do another 10 minutes. And so I had to sit like 5 different weekends so that she could finish the tattoo.
If I were, I would have just tied you down straight up.
That was the last one. I think that's going to be the last one. I know.
I think if I start getting tattoos, I'll just like fill my whole arms.
No,
and
don't do this.
Hey, I'll do what I want, but I'm not going to get tattoos now.
So I have a question. So what about when you came out to your family? Like, how was that?
I think there's this notion that it happens all at once, and it doesn't. It's a process. It's an evolving, right? And so my brother was the first one that I came out to, and he didn't care. That didn't change our relationship. I never told my dad yet. He, you know, would make comments and would say things that were evidently an acknowledgement that I was gay. And when I told my mom, it was over, you know, the dining room table. She was having coffee and probably some pan dulce reading the paper. Back then, you read the paper. And I remember me telling her that it was such a big deal for me. And all she did was look over her paper and she said, "Tell me something I don't already know." Aww. And then she put the paper back up and I'm just like, that was it. I mean, it was kind of anticlimactic.
Oh, good. Well, that's great. I mean,
I know I'm fortunate. I know there's so many other experiences where, you know, people are disowned by their families, they're kicked out of the house, they're considered the pariah of the family. Right. And so I have an acknowledgement. I'm very mindful of the fact that I was very fortunate in my experience.
So your brother, is he still in the Valley?
No, my brother, he lives in Round Rock, Texas. Oh, okay. He's married to Hannah and has a 17-year-old daughter, Erica. And
That's your niece?
That's my niece.
Oh, she's super cute.
Yes, she's high functioning, Down syndrome. We're very proud of her. And she actually just got a job as a vet tech assistant. Okay. And she's working at a local veterinarian hospital in Round Rock. And so my brother travels a lot still back and forth to the Valley because he has properties down there that he inherited from my mom and my dad. So he manages those properties. He's down there about once or twice a month. And the rest of the time he works at a French computer company in Austin and provides well enough to have Hannah take care of Erica and Erica have all the pleasures and of life that any teenager can.
I've seen her niece on Facebook.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's super cute.
That population is also really near and dear to my heart because right after college, that's what I first did. I was a service coordinator for individuals with intellectual disabilities yes. and related conditions. So I did that for like 6 years, I think.
Okay.
So that population's really near and dear to my heart. But I think you asked her something earlier about, oh, the mental health, right? And how we were saying it can be culture and all that. I remember when I was working as a service coordinator in Del Rio, I had cases where people thought that their children had autism or intellectual disabilities or whatnot because they had been like brujeria. They would do all sorts of stuff. Like they would put stuff on them and pray over them and tease and whatever. And so those cases were really difficult because when I would go in to offer these services, they'd be like, oh, no, we're taking her to a curandera in Acuña. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not going to help her.
Yeah.
So it was really difficult to get through that barrier of the understanding of like, look, they need help. Like, this Absolutely. Isn't.
Right. Yeah. And I think, again, you know, we talked about, you know, how we now know so much more. But yeah. that's still, you know, there's still, I think, pockets of folk beliefs where, and for some people it works to be that connected to Mother Earth and to use herbs and use prayer and, you know, use rituals because it has a psychological effect, right? And for many, it raises a cloud off their psyche. I mean, and, you know, some of them will say, I feel lighter or I can think more clearly or I feel cleansed. And, you know, when you have those types of metaphysical experiences, those are very different from the ones yeah. that we read about in our academia and in our clinical, right? And so I think for many cultures, it's a hybrid. You know, yes, okay, we're going to take you to the doctor, but once you take that medication, we're also going to take you to the curandero mm-hmm. to make sure we've got you in tip-top shape, you know, that your right. mind is connected to your heart, and you know. And so, you know, every culture is so unique. You know, we are fortunate enough, I think, I consider it fortunate enough to be part of a culture that is so multifaceted and how we could be treating mental illness as opposed to maybe just one way of thinking, very unilateral thinking that this is the only way to cure that. Well, maybe not so. Maybe for this particular child, it also means this. I'll tell you a story. I remember being in a court with Judge Garcia. I was the ad litem for a 12-year-old girl, maybe a little bit younger. And the person that did a psych assessment on her was on the stand and started testifying as to why she had diagnosed this child, very young child, as schizophrenic. She said, well, you know, it came down to, well, she says she talks to her grandmother every night.
Oh, I think I remember that.
And mm-hmm. Richard, Judge Garcia looks at me. So I kept questioning her about talking to her grandmother when she would pray at night mm-hmm. or in her dreams. Okay. Well, what Mexican little girl who lost her grandmother doesn't do that, right?
Straight up.
You know, and I'm just like, you're trained to stay in contact with the people in the afterlife by praying, you know, and they'll come to you and you can see them, you can talk to them. That's how you stay in touch with grandma who died last year. Or she visits you, or you talk to her, or you ask for consejos. And that hearing resulted in that professional being removed from the case. And I asked that CPS find a culturally sensitive therapist who was aware of the practices in Mexican-American families of prayer and of honoring the dead and how many people still believe that they can communicate with folks that have passed away and be guided by them and feel their spirit. You know, that resulted in a whole different milieu of treatment for that little girl. You know, she wasn't going to be diagnosed schizophrenic. Yeah. Someone was going to help her process the loss of her grandmother in a way that was spiritually and psychically healthy for her as a child.
I think in a lot of cases, we forget to realize just the communication instead of just coming up with all these diagnoses for somebody when they're just really going through it.
Right.
Aquí todos somos mexicanos, ¿verdad?
Yes. Yes.
Have you guys ever like talked to like the dead or anything like that?
Oh, I used to play Ouija a lot when I.
So Stacy talks about a Ouija board. Yeah. You know, I grew up. Brother and I grew up with a mother that believed very much in the power of formal education. And she went to school and got her bachelor's and her master's degree after the age of 40, working full time. She graduated summa cum laude. But my dad, on the other hand, had a second grade education and he was a self-proclaimed brujo and curandero. And so in the house that my brother and I grew up in, there would be trabajos. There would be the jar full of lemons, or the chicken leg hanging, or the good luck thing.
But tell them what your dad did professionally. I mean, your dad was era judicial. No?
He was aduanal, era judicial in the time where the mordida ruled, you know. So he did that for 40 years with Mexico, but he also had these very strong beliefs against the Catholic Church. He grew up in an era, una época de Mexico, when it went to a socialist country. Oh. And all the churches were shut down. Because that's what socialism was. But in addition to that, at that time in Mexico's history, they were discovering that there were a lot of babies and fetuses buried in the church graveyards. And they were the product of relationships between priests and nuns, or priests and women in the community.
I always knew that.
And so the government actually ordered them to remove their collars. They could not walk the streets of Mexico identifying themselves as priests or as nuns. They had to not wear their habits. And for my dad and us, what that translated into was when we saw a priest or a nun now in the 60s and 70s walking on this side of the street in Mexico, my dad would make us cross the street. We're not going to walk on the same side as a priest or a nun. That was his belief. On the other side of the house, I had my mom, vámonos, classes, that catechism class, hacer su comunión, everything. Play the rosary, go to mass every Sunday.
Did you go to private Catholic school?
No, I went to a public school, and so did my brother. And my dad would only speak Spanish, and my mom would only speak English. My dad did not speak Pocho or Tex-Mex. My mom wanted everyone to speak like Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather. And so my brother and I found this balance, and we got the best of both worlds, and we learned to navigate between that very bipolar family.
Let me just point something out real quick. One, I always knew priests and nuns got it in with each other. I just always had a feeling, for sure.
I mean,
so I'm glad he just woke me up to that realization. And number two, if anyone could be a judge, it is you.
How is that?
What? Why? Because, I mean, your dad and your mom are very different, but it seems like they worked everything out and they were compatible. And then you got to experience her perspective, his perspective.
Yep.
And then two, well, you're also gay. The fact that, you know, like, who are you to judge, you know? Who are we to judge? No one's. Yeah. Who are we to judge? Nobody's nobody.
You know, I think that's why, you know, as judges, you know, there's that. And it didn't always used to be this way. I don't know. I got to study more when they put the blindfold on Lady Justice. Because historically, Lady Justice did not originate with the blindfold. And it's somewhere in history, a blindfold was placed on her. And now it's explained that the blindfold is there because justice is blind. You're not supposed to be able to see, you know, what the person looks like, what they're wearing. You know, you're just supposed to absorb the evidence and make a decision based on the evidence presented, not on the individual's presentation.
Now you breaking that down gives me a different perspective on that, because I always thought that justice was blind, but through corruption. That's the way I saw it, you know? She having her eyes covered. Why she had it covered was because of corruption, because of like all these wrong choices. And it's because people are blind. Although we see each other, people are blind and they make choices because of...
So lack of knowledge, kind of?
So like, it's like, I mean, for example, if you can use race, ethnicity, you know, anything like that, you know, they will sentence you to whatever, you know, because of how you look. But that's because they're blind. So that's the way I saw it. But now the way you say it, that gives me a different perspective. Like, wow, that's very interesting.
Created Lady Justice.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm sure we can find out. Yeah.
I never thought of that. I wonder.
I'm thinking maybe the Greeks had some
I have to ask my son.
Deity to justice. I mean, they had a deity for everything else, right?
Right, exactly.
The Greeks are very smart.
So what's your faith now? Like, what do you follow?
Yeah, I consider myself a cultural Catholic because I was, you know, raised in that faith. I know that my great-grandmother, Mama Lola, was of Jewish persuasions.
Mara's
Jewish. So,
I'm converting.
You are.
Yeah.
My 23andMe came back as a slice of Eskenazi Jew.
Yay.
I love the Jews.
But, you know, I think...
On your mom's side?
Yes.
So you're Jewish.
I'd have to look into whether it's my mom or my dad's side.
If it's on your mom's side, then you're Jewish.
Well, on my grandmother's side, where my mom is, it was my mom's grandmother who is Mama Lola.
So then your mom.
The 23andMe shows me more than half Portuguese Spanish, then followed by Native American, then Sardinian, Italian Sardinian, and then Eskenazi Jew.
Interesting.
Right?
So Eastern European.
Yeah, sort of. Native American. Kind of the La Raza Cosmica, right?
Oh.
I feel like we all have like some Jewish traits in us.
Well, I mean, they came over on all the ships because they were the money counters.
Yeah.
And so the crown believed that they were too saintly or too righteous to touch money. And so they hired the Jewish bankers, the Jewish money handlers to travel to the New World to handle money, to be the businessmen.
I have a question for the both of you. Do you think religion divides us, or the people within the religion divide the people?
Well, there's religion and there's spirituality. So I don't want to start on the premise that religion exists for everybody. Religion, as I see it, is a roadmap to spirituality for folks who have not found their way to their spiritual existence. I do believe that people can find spirituality without a roadmap. You don't need religion to be spiritual and have a connection to God.
I agree.
And so you can use a textbook, you can use a map, that's your religion. But if you don't, and if you're already got there, then, you know, what you as an agnostic or say, you can pray directly to God. You don't need a middle person. Yeah. I don't need a priest or a deacon or a nun to tell me what God is saying to me. My God may not be your God. It's a God of my personal understanding. And so some people don't have a God. You know, some people believe we are microorganism full of neurons and protons and electrons, and we're masses walking around, and there's an energy that is at the center of this earth that, you know, rotates around a sun. And that sun is one of billions of suns in an ever-expanding universe that's still exploding, right? And so there are folks that believe that there is no God. There's just this matter out there. So that's why I always say, you know, you may be a believer, you may not be. There's over 4,300 religions that exist in the world today. Christianity is in a minority of those religions. Mm-hmm. So again, I believe more in a spiritual connection. I was raised Catholic, respecting outside beliefs, those of my father. And my mom always said to us, when you get old enough, you'll be able to choose what you want to do. I will walk into any house of worship that accepts me for who I am authentically. And I will walk out of any house of worship that tries to shame me into being something that I'm not, or trying to shame me and telling me that my existence is an aberration to them.
I like that.
So that's interesting. Yeah, so I'm going through a conversion process to Judaism. So I've been going through this process for about 8 months now, and it's coming to an end. That's it. Last night was my last class with a rabbi in Jerusalem. And the next step is I will go to Puebla, Mexico to present myself in front of like a rabbinic council for questioning and, you know, to see if I learned what I needed to learn.
To deem yourself worthy of conversion.
Right, I guess. Yeah. Cool. So that's the next step.
Awesome.
So with that, I was going to ask you if you'll do a mosaic for me of a Star of David.
Absolutely.
Because I saw the cross with the Star of David, but I just want a Star of David.
Sure. We'll talk about how you want that. Do you want a flat surface?
Whatever you want.
What colors you want.
Whatever your creativity brings to you.
Okay.
I saw the Hamsa. That's really cute.
Stacy did that one. Yeah, Stacy did that.
The little hand.
That's pretty cool.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess while you're doing hers, you know, just think about me doing that.
You want me too, of course.
Hey, can't forget about the podcast.
El que no habla ni Dios lo oye, right?
Yes, sir.
Cierto.
De volada se apunta. Todo quiere.
Hey, the most successful people in our lives are those that jump at an opportunity, right? Right. You have to always be ready for any opportunity.
Absolutely, for sure.
That's why when I asked him, like, hey, we should do the food bank. I'm telling you, in a week we had it down.
Hey, if y'all want to show up to do the bed build, we're doing the bed build on Saturday.
What is it?
There's a nonprofit in town called Sleeping in Heavenly Peace.
That sounds amazing. Okay.
And they have a small warehouse located near Wetmore and Broadway. And I can give you the address tomorrow. And they raise money to buy materials to build beds for children in need of beds. At present, as we speak tonight, there are over 1,500 children in Bexar County who are sleeping on sofas or on the floor or like six to a bed.
Yeah.
Sleep in Heavenly Peace has over 800 applicants waiting for their beds to be made. So they look for sponsorships. Usually $5,000 pays for 25 beds to be made. For this particular bed build, two of my friends out of the San Antonio Four, the women that were wrongfully convicted, Cassie Rivera and Elizabeth Ramirez, are sponsoring the bed build. And so they're going to cover the $5,000 together. And on Saturday, we're trying to get 45 people to show up at 9 o'clock on Saturday. What they do is they give us the raw materials and they get cut into posts, and we drill the holes and we attach the hardware, and they get put into bed kits. We make the kits, and then on another weekend we go with the men and to distribute them.
Oh, I would love
to. So we go deliver it to the children's houses. Some of them get bunk beds, some of them get a single twin bed, and they build them at the house, and they get built, and then the mattress is included with the bedding and the pillows. And
who gives you the mattresses?
They have a deal with Walmart right now. Okay. And I know that Greg Brockhouse is also reaching out to them, because he reached out through me and I just referred him to their board of directors. But he has contact with some mattress company that
mattress firm?
Is willing to make twin size mattresses for children and provide them.
That's awesome.
It's a non-profit?
Sleep in Heavenly Peace, yes. It's actually like a franchise. They have chapters all over the country, and the San Antonio chapter is located over there at Wetmore and Broadway. I'll give you the address tomorrow. So we're all reporting on Saturday at 9, and it usually is done in 2 hours. The bolada. And they make the kits, and we're done, and then they give us another date to show up to go deliver the beds.
Wow, that's so cool.
That is pretty cool.
So tell Jorge about the ladies, the wrongfully convicted ladies.
So back in the 90s, four women in San Antonio, Elizabeth Ramirez, Ana Vasquez, Cassie Rivera, and Christy Mayhew, they all knew each other. There were two couples between the four of them. And one of them had nieces and nephews that she was babysitting. They were the children of her sister and her now divorced ex-husband. And the ex-husband came to drop them off to her, left them with her for a week or two until she finally got a hold of him and said, "Hey man, come pick up the kids." And he picked them up. And from that just started this nightmare for all four of them, because all four of the women had been at that apartment over those 2 weeks. It was alleged that the girls had made outcries that the four women had sexually molested them. Before you knew it, they were found guilty. And all four of them maintained their innocence. Mm-hmm. And they all four served over 10 years in prison. I think Elizabeth maybe have served 16, 17. Cassie may have served 12 to 13. Anna served 11. I mean, it was just...
One of them works in your office?
She was one of my clerks.
It was two kids?
Two little girls.
Mm-hmm. Two little girls.
And so one of the girls turned 18. And when she turned 18, she said, "I'm going to make this right." And she went and she recanted and said, "This never happened. And my dad and my grandma made me say this." And it just started a process of undoing this whole conviction. And it did. It got undone. The conviction was vacated. And then they were exonerated.
There's a documentary called
Southwest of Salem. Mm-hmm.
Southwest of Salem.
And you can find it on YouTube. You can find it on Hulu. And there's a DVD. So I also have the DVD. So.
And sometimes they do like panels.
They've been on panels for our domestic violence and our child abuse class. But they also speak to Stacy's classes, counselors and therapists she teaches. So they're going to be speaking to her class tomorrow night.
So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
But, can we go? I want to sign up. Can I go to the class?
So by the time one of the daughters, made things right, did they all finish their sentencing?
No, they were all still in prison.
They were all released?
They were all released.
Did they get any checks or anything like that?
They all have very good lives.
But imagine all the time they lost in prison.
Ten years
of your life just sitting in a cell.
Their children were raised by other people. They missed birthdays.
Everything,
they missed quinceañeras.
Life.
They missed deaths of their parents. They missed all sorts of things.
That's pretty sad.
And imagine, we had, I think it was last year.
If you were the judge, that would have never happened.
I don't know. You know, I can never say. You know.
And this was here in Bexar County?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't want to know who that judge was.
Well, he's passed. It was Judge Priest.
Oh, okay. We had another gentleman that came to UIW one time, and he also was on a speaker.
Yeah, he's part of Doshi Piper's, I think, group.
Exactly.
Doshi has had the lady speak at Incarnate Word several times. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. She's had me speak there. She's also had that gentleman. Oh, I can't think of his name. I can see his face.
It's a black gentleman. I can't remember.
Oh, okay. So yeah, she's had several. She's had several, and they all have to do with criminal justice.
Right.
The miscarriage of justice.
So why don't you... Or have you thought of approaching UIW about a similar class like what you do at UTSA?
Well, I just hadn't thought of it. I know that Our Lady of the Lake did approach me, and I had meetings with them, but they have a certification to keep up, and because I don't have a master's in social work.
Who does? They do.
You're right. They're a requirement.
Okay, because
like I'm an adjunct, kind of like a visiting lecturer at UTSA. Mm-hmm. That's how I can teach there. Their School of Social Work is trying to figure out a way maybe I can do the same thing at Our Lady of the Lake. I'm not sure how that, if that's going to pan out the way we want it, but I'm always open to teaching.
It would be amazing. Because you're right. Like I was thinking, you know, I did my bachelor's there in psychology, and honestly, like no one ever told me this is the real world. Like when I left the university, I didn't really know what kind of work I could do. I mean, I just happened to fall into mental health right out of college, which I think was an amazing experience because that really helped me to build a foundation for everything else, because there's so many facets and so many issues in that population. But no one ever told me, like, this is what case management looks like.
Right.
This is what you can do with a bachelor's in psychology.
Sure, sure.
No one ever did that. So I think that that would be a really neat class for our students, because the majority of the students there that are doing, you know, psychology or sociology or CJ majors, that's what they're going to end up doing.
Yep.
Is case management or probation.
Yep.
I mean,
document.
What else can you go into, right?
Right.
Document. Everything, like...
They're trackers.
Yeah, we're trackers. We're paper shovers and trackers and, like... So it's interesting because... Now with like other jobs that I've had, when like, but it's a lot of paperwork. I'm like, oh, you don't know what a lot of paperwork is.
No, I always tell people,
this is nothing.
If you cut your teeth into the arena of the helping professions and social work at Child Protective Services, that was your first professional job, you can work anywhere after that, because you have been burnt by, you have been baptized by fire water, as they say.
Exactly. Like, yeah. I mean, you can work with all populations. You can work heavy caseloads.
Under extreme amounts of stress.
Manage your time, stress, so much stress. But the crazy thing is that I don't know if, well, you're still in that field, but I miss the stress. I love the stress.
I think it was the adrenaline.
The adrenaline. Yeah. I miss it. Like, I go to work and
because if you know how to manage your adrenaline, you're not stressful. You're not stressed, right?
It's
when you don't know how to handle the adrenaline and
I
how to be
the adrenaline.
how to use that adrenaline right. To be your most productive. Then you start to stress out because you feel you're not doing enough.
You come into work and you just have so many fires you need to put out, and you're like, "Ooh, let me put out this fire."
And there's not enough hours in the day, you know, to get all the work done that needs to get done. It can be exhausting.
It can be, but
so self-care is real important,
right? But I think when you're doing it passionately, you don't even feel that you're exhausted
because
you're so passionate about it.
Because you're driven. You see it more as a vocation rather than a job.
Right.
And there's a difference.
So like with Jorge, he's doing his master's in communication arts, but I keep telling him that I think he would be really good in a like public affairs role.
Sure. I mean, I know, like, for example, Lucy Adami Clark, our county clerk, she's always looking for people that can send her message out to the masses in different on different platforms and different venues. Like, she had a person, all they did was her social media all day long. That was a position to PR on social media and get photographs out and do reports and things like that.
I'm going to be honest with you, but I hate social media. There's a lot of pros in social media. I'm not taking away a lot of that. You know, there's definitely a lot of pros. Well, I'm using it to market, which I think is a pro.
I think because you're more of a people person, so you don't feel like the need to communicate through social media because...
You value in-person contact more than you do virtual contact.
Absolutely.
Right. And then there's people that are the other way around. They seem to open up on a virtual platform as opposed to the anxiety of having to interact with people on a one-to-one basis. Takes all kinds, right?
Right.
You guys were on it. I love having the human interaction. COVID is so sad to me. You can't really like study someone's expression, especially when the mask is covering their face.
Oh, so that's true. I didn't think about that.
You know, you always pay attention to like those little small details, and that takes.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some sort of fallout after COVID because people have gotten used to not having their facial expressions read, and so they're very comfortable behind the mask. And you know, who knows what they're doing behind the mask? And once we take them off, all of a sudden, you're going to be able to see everybody's expression.
They're
going to be like, "What's wrong
colors.
With you? What do you mean? You just made an ugly face." Right. I did.
Así no, como dijo mi amiga que, ay no, Marta, mi amiga dijo. Ay, se va a poner la máscara y decir, ay, mi amor, yo pensaba que eras tú el que andaba abrazando. And I was like, estás bien loca.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it's like, I don't know. I I don't want to wear a mask. I don't like
it. Nobody does, you know? And we are, I think, experiencing COVID fatigue. And I just say that for myself, in the last week, it seems like every day I leave my car at the courthouse to go walk toward the courthouse, I have to come back because I forgot my mask. And I was like on it, like white on rice, you know? It was always in my hand. I was always putting it on. And then in the last week, it's just slipping my mind. And I'm just like, is this what they call COVID fatigue? Where you're just not thinking about, you just, you know, se te va la onda and you're not thinking about it anymore. I don't know.
All right. So, I'm sorry. Were you
going to
say something?
I was just going to ask you guys one more question before you close this up. Okay. But did you want to say something before?
No, I wanted to ask her something really quick. You said self-care is really important. So what do you do for self-care?
I like that.
Well, you know, before I went to law school, you know, I've always been kind of physically active. The summer before I started law school, I was, you know, I competed in powerlifting. I was this, you know, at that particular meet, my ranking was state champ for the deadlift and the bench press at 33. I've always been attracted to, you know, weightlifting. And as I've gotten older, you know, and more busy, that's kind of lagged. But I try to get on the treadmill, you know, at least two or three times a week. I have weights. I have a punching bag. Try to keep that physical activity up. I'm 55. I'm closer to 56. But I know for a fact, I'm not on single medication. You know, I don't have high cholesterol. I don't have high blood pressure. And so I'm, you know, proud of the fact that at my age, still relatively healthy. But that takes work. You know, you got to watch what you eat. You know, definitely get enough sleep. My mom is always, you know, she stays with me. And she always used to say that lack of sleep was the root to all evil.
Right.
It ages you if you do not sleep. Mm-hmm. You put on weight if you do not sleep. It affects your mood if you do not sleep. You are not productive if you do not sleep. You develop health problems if you do not sleep. Your body uses sleep to regenerate and recuperate itself. So it's very important. And now the studies are coming out, and I'm very sensitive to it, that lack of sleep is one of the markers for developing Alzheimer's, because it is during a deep sleep that the brain plaque breaks down. If you don't sleep enough, that brain plaque that develops the toxins in your brain stay there. And it's like dental plaque. If you don't remove it, it hardens and it affects the way your brain operates. And that's Alzheimer's. But if you get enough sleep along with the proper diet, that brain plaque burns off. I believe in fasting because it allows the brain to regenerate as well as your other cells to regenerate. I'm not going to go and fast for, you know, 24 hours or, you know, but I'll skip breakfast to make sure that my pistons are firing sharply. You know, at lunchtime, I'll have a good lunch and a light dinner. At my age, your metabolism changes. You know, that's something I would say to my younger self, you know, eat as much as you can right now, because as soon as you hit the 40s, it's going to come to a skids and you're going to gain weight if you're not taking care of yourself. Another wise thing my mom said to me before she left this earth, it was whatever weight you are at 50 years old, that is the weight that is your weight. And so if you're heavy in your 40s and you want to be healthy after your 50s, you better be at a healthy weight at 50, you know? And she said, pretty much no matter what I did after 50, it didn't matter how much I walked or how much I ate, I stayed at the same weight. So, you know, I was at a healthy weight at 50. I still work at trying to kind of maintain, you know, not looking too thick. But you have to watch your Alzheimer's, your brain plaque. You need to get enough sleep.
Sleeping is really important.
It is.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, they're like, oh, I'm on this diet, I'm on that diet. No. And then the first thing I ask them is like, how much do you sleep? Oh, 4 hours.
You know why? Because they can't sleep because they're hungry.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
You know? So, you know, it's important sleeping to eat the right kind of food, important. You know? And
food's a medicine.
I'm sorry?
Food's a medicine.
Food heals, you know? And, the more scratch food it is and from scratch and from the field and not processed and not fried and, you know, it's fresh fish and fresh vegetables.
Tacos también ricos.
Tacos de pescado.
Tacos del chief.
Tacos de, what is it? Blue corn tortillas are so good for you, you know?
Yeah.
There's ways. There's ways.
Speaking of sleep, make sure you do community service this Saturday.
Oh, that's right.
We sleep one third of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, throughout our day, we should sleep at least one third of our day.
Right, 8 hours.
8 hours.
But, that varies, too, on your age. And so some say, like for me, it's a solid six to 7 hours.
Yeah.
If I sleep close to eight, I am aching to get out of bed. Literally aching. My body starts to hurt if I stay in bed too long. I need to get out of bed.
There's some people that are like that.
Yeah.
I've slept on the floor before for like a month just because I can stay up for a bed. It is what it is with life, you know? And
One thing that I really did invest in with this new apartment was investing in a really good bed.
Oh, yeah.
It's made such a difference in my life. I feel more productive, more rested, more recovered. And like when I wake up, I'm just alert and I'm ready.
See, you didn't have to go through the waterbed phase.
I wanted the water bed.
Oh my God. My mom said, hell no. You'd be like, hey.
Oh, no. No.
You had one?
Yeah, I had a water bed. My back parents in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's so weird, right? Who even came up with that
idea? Who knows? But, you know, it was popular.
My parents thought I would have popped it. So
yeah,
they
you
never,
probably would have.
Yeah, I probably would have.
You know what I like when you go to the beach and you spend the whole day in the water, and then when you go to bed at night and you're sleeping and you still feel like you're on the beach.
Well, that happens when you go on a cruise. You got what they call legs, sailor legs.
Oh yeah.
Because you still when you get on the ground, you're still like swaying and stuff.
I've never been on a cruise.
Oh, you need to. Royal Caribbean's the best.
Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like there's so many germs.
I was the same.
Worried about germs?
I was the same way. I was the same way until Stacy convinced me that this would be the adventure of a lifetime. And it was. And we went to another cruise after that. And we actually had a cruise scheduled for next month in January. And that got postponed to 2022.
Where were you going?
We're going to leave out of Miami. And we're going to Jamaica, Haiti, and Chichen Itza.
Oh, Chichen Itza.
We're going to the pyramids. Yes.
Very nice.
Have you been there, right?
No. I've been to Puerto Vallarta, Nuevo Vallarta, Acapulco, DF, Matehuala. I've been to all sorts of parts of Mexico.
Oaxaca?
Never been to Oaxaca. That's somewhere I definitely want to go, but I want to take Stacy during Día de Muertos.
Oh, Día de los Muertos.
Yes.
Ah, qué padre.
But yes. You need to go to Oaxaca.
I've been to San Miguel de Allende, León, Guanajuato, but not to Oaxaca.
Not to Oaxaca. I still don't experience Mexico. I've only gone to Monterrey, Chihuahua.
Been to Monterrey.
Ciudad Juárez.
Yeah.
So, Ciudad Juárez, next El Paso, sí.
Mexico is even more diverse in geography and in culture and in dialects than the U.S. It is the gem of this hemisphere.
No, yes. And I think if you've traveled to Mexico, like once you go to Italy and stuff, you're like, it's nice, but we have that in Mexico.
Yeah,
like
all the European stuff.
You could experience
stuff.
That
yes.
same vibe and that same in Mexico.
Yes,
without.
I agree 100%.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for us to travel.
Porque como México solo hay uno.
Yes, absolutely.
Y por las mexicanas, pues bien
chingonas. Y tienen los modelos.
Ajá, los modelos. A ver, un mensaje a todas las mujeres latinas.
A todas las mujeres, el mensaje es que con ganas y Dios todo se puede.
Así es.
Me gusta.
Amén. Amén.
No, pues si está bien contigo, con ustedes, ya podemos cerrar este podcast. Lo podemos terminar
bueno,
así.
Pero para el podcast yo le digo bendito entre las mujeres.
Ah, sí, tú, bendito entre las mujeres. Pobrecito, no sabe.
Ey, calmado. Bueno, pues, gracias a los dos. I want to thank you guys both for being part of this After Hours podcast. And I hope to do more podcasts with both of you guys. It was
absolutely
such a great time.
Okay.
Thank you guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.